finding, then, that the two great sources of comparison, namely grammatical structure and roots, are liable through labored investigation to resolve themselves into great probabilities of a common origin, we propose to deal with this difficulty by considering whether there is not in nature herself, and the attempts of primeval man to emerge from barbarism and express his progress in the form of language, quite sufficient testimony of a deductive character to show that language is nature's own impulse to express ideas, and that as ideas multiply, forms accumulate, and a large range of objects to represent, necessitates a large range of language. These all grow proportionally together, and develop in increasing ratio with each other. The study of philology is so complicated and so diverse that it would be impossible, in answering one question, to enter more deeply into it, but we may here add, we cannot accept of the bald definitions concerning roots which scholars give. Tracing it to the origin of roots, language starts with nature. Roots, indeed, are distributed amongst various nations, but whether we search amongst the Greek roots, or the Hebrew, or even the Sanskrit and Chinese, there is a wonderful similarity in each, and in each a resemblance to many of the sounds which are still uttered by savage nations. We believe that all roots are the inevitable expressions of nature, that they are the words which God puts into the mouth of ancient Adam when he arrays all things in creation before him, and bids him name them. They come even as the conception of color comes. We name it, it is inevitable to us, and could we trace back the earliest attempt to found a language, we should arrive there at the true name of all things. Varieties of language arise simply in harmony with the varieties of nations, of customs, and the growth of ideas. Permit me to add to this answer one thought that is not included in the question. It is this: in the most advanced spheres of spiritual life there is no spoken language, no outward form of speech. All communication is perception. Spirits look upon each other, and know and understand each one's addresses by EHB 96, thoughts. Spirits behold the flower and realize its meaning. It is a hieroglyphic, having a meaning far deeper than its beauty, bloom, or perfume merely. It is a part of nature, and where it appears it represents to the comprehensive mind its entire history, place, and affinities in creation. And so of all colors, sounds, shapes, and forms, all and each are far more of meaning than their more external appearance. They mean good and evil, light and darkness, mind as well as matter, and metaphysics like physics. All that is bright or dark in the human soul is as much mapped out in color, sound, and shape, as in outward expressions of deeds themselves. There are most potent meanings in sound, meanings in the very utterances of nature, which, to the quick ear of the spirit who understands nature, are appreciable at once. Consequently, all creation's harmonies speak so intelligibly to the spirit, that speech which is but an imperfect mode of attempting to interpret thought, and which is confined simply to the material form, is no longer needed by the spirit. The foundations of language exist in barbarism. The ultimatum of language is civilization, while its necessity ceases with spiritual perfection. We commence with the rudest forms of matter, making sounds to attract attention. We end with that knowledge which needs no other expression than the perception of the spirit. Question: for what was the state of the human race in its first creation, and what did it lose by the fall? Answer: your questions are so shaped as to make one answer another. What was the state of the flora and the fauna in the earliest periods of the earth's history? The flora was rough, rude, coarse, simple. The fauna were either strange, grotesque, and monstrous, or else humble mollusks, or simple radiata. The vertebrate animal and mammalia came at length, but came as growths in the progressive order of nature. What then must have been the first condition of humanity, when the atoms of matter were sublimated enough, by passing through immense varieties of animal forms, to produce man? He came as did the flora and fauna. Whenever the conditions for life were fitted to originate him, and wherever in every part of the known world there was a capacity to produce man, thus did he come, in harmony with the development of all other forms of being, and in no special or different mode. The fall. The fall from what? From ignorance to knowledge. Is that a fall? from barbarism to civilization, from infancy to manhood. Thus, and thus only, has man fallen, in no other sense, that we can discover. Even if we could accept of that which lacks all scientific authority, that is, authority in aught but the allegorical mode of representing the exodus of mankind from its state of innocence into knowledge, as rendered in the Jewish scriptures, if we could accept of any other historical account of the origin of man than that which nature, science, and the harmonies of both point out, our reverence for the great architect of creation would induce us to deny the possibility that he could make any mistake in his creation, or so great a failure in his all-wise purposes as you imply in the term of the fall. How would you deem of any human workman who should fashion a machine with the intention that it should perform a certain work and who so failed to accomplish his purpose, that in anger or disgust at addresses by EHB 97, its failure he should next proceed to destroy it? And yet more, after having condemned his first work as worthless, that he should hit upon no other mode of improving on his failure than the recreation of a machine similar to the old. We have before, in this place, been compelled to point to the fact, that we accept of the historical account of the fall of man rendered in your scriptures, as that which Christ and his apostles claimed it to be, and allegory, the teaching of the letter which killeth, requiring the interpretation of the Spirit to make that scripture life and wisdom. Were we to take the entire of the history of the Jewish scriptures and measure them by the definition rendered by St. Paul, himself one of the noblest and best of the theological writers amongst the Jews, we should say that even the history of Abraham and Sarah, according to him, is an allegory, which things are an allegory, he writes. We need not inquire into these mysticisms now. It is enough for us to know that science now gives us absolute proofs concerning the origin of material forms, the construction of society, and the growth of civilization, knowledge, and human history. All this carries us back to Central Asia, where strange, rude troglodyte remains of humanity are the first monuments of the race, and these represent a people of whom we have even no history, no tradition. A small, dwarfish, woolly-headed race are there sculptured, and from this alone, besides innumerable other sources of witness, we may gather something of our first view of primeval man upon this earth. Why do we question so doubtfully the origin of man, more than that of any other being or form of being? Science assures us that we need but place the conditions for life in order anywhere, to ensure its manifestation. Associate moisture, air, heat, and solid matter together. Assemble the elements of life, whether in the vegetable or animal world, in due juxtaposition, and we have life, life in the insect, reptile, animal, or the vegetable form. All things attending to life, is man alone an exception? No. It is the glory and sublimity of creation to recognize that its grandest and culminating points of existence, man, proceeds in the march of the ages just where he should be, as the last work performed in the grand laboratory, but ultimated by the same simple and sublime laws that pervade all nature beside. It is in reverence for God's laws rather than skepticism of what man calls his word, that we believe the Creator has made no failure in creation. We reject, therefore, the literal interpretation of the fall, as rendered by a literal interpretation of your scriptures, and, whilst we believe that the babe falls from the state of pure, angelic innocence, which is, after all, but ignorance, to the condition of manhood, which in the knowledge of good and evil may prove him to be no longer the ignorant and innocent, but the very guilty man, so do we recognize that humanity changes by growth, and in that sense, and in no other, do we recognize a fall for man. Question 5. Will you explain the process of death, and of birth into the spirit world? Answer. Death and birth, whether into the natural or the spiritual worlds, are one and the same thing. Mortal death is but the birth of the soul into the spirit world. There is, perhaps, no more beautiful or philosophical explanation of death than that passage, so addresses by EHB 98, often quoted and yet so little understood, that the wages of sin is death. We do not mean by sin the guilt of criminal action only, but sin is imperfection, imperfection throughout the realm of nature. There is a law by which all things harmonize. They commence from a point, they grow up from the smallest atom in being, become a center of attraction, and, by the inherent life in all things, gather up from the various elements that surround them, materials to build up the form to which they tend. They arrive at last at the culmination point of their vigorous growth, and from this stage they have no more power to attract a sufficient amount of life elements to sustain the now decaying form. They have turned the hill of time, and descend into its valleys, they waste more than they gather in, and, at last, when the power of attraction is ended, when the electrical pull of the battery of life can no more draw the elements from nature necessary to sustain being, the spirit withdraws, the gates of life are closed against it, and the spirit, fully ripened for another world, is born therein. This is the history of all forms, whether in what is called the inanimate or the animated world. And thus the history of birth, life and death are but sequences one to the other. As the seed dies, the shoot grows from it, and hence the development of the plant, the blossom, the new seed, and then the death of the whole structure, and the gathering in of whatsoever it has produced, the flax, the hemp, the cotton. We kill the fiber, as fiber, in order that it shall live again in some fresh and more useful condition. We weave it into this fabric, holding up a handkerchief, and now it is full of life. There is some mysterious power of attraction that binds together these particles. We see it not, but today it is, a few years hence and it shall be dead, dead in its present form, but still living in some other element than this shape. This fabric will be crumbled into dust, but the attraction that binds it together now will be somewhere in existence, and every atom gathered up into the great totality of matter. Nothing is lost, visible or invisible. The process by which this substance decays from the culminating point of its life and vigor until it dies, is very gradual, but it comes at last, and in the death of this substance it liberates the attraction into the vast laboratory of attraction, and so even the substance of this thing, which is the life principle, is born into some other substance. The vast earth itself was born, from the death of the comet. The comet was a birth from the nebulae of some starry mass in the skies, and this again was condensed as a birth from the unparticled nature of the elements. As one state of nature died, another was born from it. All is the same, even in the vast sums of life existing in suns, satellites, and worlds. Our Earth is very young, it has not yet attained its full culminating point of life. But there is a period when matter must progress to a standard of final growth, and then turn the hill of time, and perhaps die. Mountains, vast hills, and gigantic rocky ranges, all these grow, aggregating unto themselves the elements that form them from mere atoms. They reach their vast life's manhood, and then the attraction passes from them, they crumble into dust, and perish. I have said thus much to show you that the law of life and death is pervasive in all things alike, even so with human life and the relations of matter with spirit. I have before traced the embryotic cell in its processes of growth, and shown how a mere monad of matter gathers up from its surroundings the elements that extend it into the rudiments of a brain, and then, by throwing off fibers, forms a nervous system. Then proceed to secrete the various elements that build it up into a heterogeneous and organic structure, until at last it produces a fully formed and living being. It is then born into another sphere than its embryotic one, even into the outer life of Earth addresses by EHB 99, and from this birth, growth proceeds, until the magical transmutation from the wailing babe into the strong and mighty man is fully effected. When we contemplate the grand and powerful form of man, the man of muscle, knowledge, and mind, we may cry, "Can this then be the babe? Surely the babe is dead, and the man is the growth from its altered life." A. And such are the processes of life in the mighty changes that are effected through growth. The only diversity in man is the fact that he has gathered up from all things in nature the elements that make him man. When he arrives at manhood, he still builds up the form with aliment and elements, but he wastes more than he attracts, and so he gradually decays, and if life is permitted to attain to its full and natural periods of being, the waning life of man will slowly pass away, and the repulsive force shall prevail over the attractive, till the hour shall come when the powers of life shall feebly pulsate, and then be quenched in the eternal sleep of death. But even then, Whilst the freed spirit escapes from the broken casket, the forces of motion shall act in the crumbling form, but operate only in the mode of repulsion or decay. 'Tis strange and touching to observe how, in the age of feeble man, as the spirit nears the bright and shining shore, and the glorious forms of the immortals gleam across the beautiful river in dreamy shadowy visions, scarce understood, or deemed hallucination, how surely the normal decay of the earthly powers seems to enlarge the border of the spiritual, and the old and feeble man, in his state of gradual abstraction, seems to be drawn nearer and nearer to the shining shore, to which his soul is speeding. He feels the invisible cords that are drawing him away from the realms of matter to the home of his soaring spirit. Earth's landscapes grow more dim, but the visionary glory of a brighter world breaks ever through the gloom. As Earth's twilight closes round him, heaven's stars come trooping up on the firmament of mind, until, when the midnight hour of mortal death is sounding, the last vibrating echo of the bell is lost in the glorious morning chime that heralds in the arisen day of spiritual existence. This is not death, but birth. The changes of mortal life are but the immortal's growth, and whilst the body fades like a worn-out garment, the spirit shakes it off in the normal birth of a new and better state. Death. There is no death. It is but change from one glory to another, it is but the birth from one sphere to another. Death is a liberty angel, which opens the door of matter for the captive soul bound in the dungeons of earth. Death pays the wages of sin, for sin is the imperfection of the worn-out body, unable to sustain and fulfill the uses of existence longer. Death is the beautiful and holy steward, that pays back to the earth all the wages of earth's imperfection. Have you ever passed by the graves of those who have perished from out your midst by violence, with a stain of evil on their names, and not felt the loathing with which society regards the criminal softened by the change of death, until your voice grows low and pitiful as you speak of them, and the tone of harsh reproach is changed to kind regret? And thus is it ever. Death is the penalty of sin, and its just demands fulfilled. We feel, if we fail to comprehend our thought, that the good alone is eternal and preserved, the evil is a transitory shadow which death in part dispels. The good man becomes exalted through the gloom of death into actual sainthood, the evil melts like midnight shades in the bright revealments of a spiritual day. So death is the mighty alchemist whose work it is to transmute earth's base metals into spiritual gold. Let the old past die. Old buildings, forms, old architecture, customs and habits, all must perish, but in their death spring up the new and beautiful. The great architect of creation gathers up the beautiful with addresses by EHB 100, such perfection and fidelity, that nothing good can die. Rome and Greece are in ashes, but their faults alone have perished, their virtues still survive. Their histories of warning and instruction are with us still, their arts and sciences are the foundations of our schools and colleges, their pride and luxury, their reckless waste of life, their dark superstitious rites, and spirit of greedy conquest. Death had swallowed up their grand achievements in the games of intellectual warfare, all immortal as the souls that battled for the good, and won, through triumph over evil. In physics as in metaphysics, the imperfect only dies. The sin alone can perish. So I hail the angel of death, as the genius of progress, and that not alone for the soul, but for the earth on which we live. Surely it would be cumbered with forms of the effete, the old and worn, did not kind glorious death sweep away with the besom of destruction, the relics of the imperfect in the past, while it still conserves the spirit of the beautiful in never-dying life. Question 6. What is the philosophy of spiritual possession? Answer: spiritual possession is at once one of the most perplexing and apparently paradoxical spiritual problems which can be offered to human philosophy to solve. It has been vaguely stated by some spirit communications that like attracts like, and hence that the pure and virtuous cannot attract, and therefore cannot be possessed by the impure and unholy spirit. Again, it has been represented that, as the spirit medium, or the person capable of being possessed by spirits, becomes so by virtue of some specialty in the physique, the moral and intellectual status of the spiritual influence is not necessarily determined by that of the medium, it is simply, therefore, a question of whether the medium is susceptible in its physical structure of the influence of spirits, and, if so, the rest depends on the ability and will of the spirit to exercise control. It must have been remarked by those who have had much experience in the unhappy condition called spiritual possession, that its subjects are far more constantly found amongst young children, fair girls, and pure women, than amongst the impure and naturally vicious, also, that the exhibition of this calamitous state seldom takes place amongst spiritualists, but rather in persons unacquainted with the subject of spiritualism, and, again, that the line of demarcation between acknowledged lunacy and spiritual possession is exceedingly difficult to draw. To the experienced in such matters, this fact seems to be obviously overlooked by the medical faculty generally. In the first place, then, we would urge that lunacy is not always spirit possession, that the latter state exists alone, but can coexist with lunacy. We believe that the influence of spirits upon the human mind is the normal and healthful relation between the two worlds, that the action of the spirit in the various phases of mediumship, and the possibility of a spirit's possessing temporarily the organism of a medium for the purpose of temporary control is also legitimate, and, under proper conditions, healthful and beneficial, physically as well as spiritually. But, in the case of a spirit entering into the organism and willfully maintaining possession of it, either against the addresses by EHB 101, desire of the subject or for the expression of words or actions objectionable to that subject, is diabolical, and only takes place under conditions of mental or bodily disease, and in its results is always pernicious and highly to be deprecated. In the first place, then, we claim that no spirit mediumship occurs so much in accordance with the mental as with physical states. Hence, the finely strung nervous organisms of women are more favorable to the electrical conditions of spiritual control than those of men, while the very susceptible forms of the young and fragile are still more liable to become subjects of magnetic influence. In the case of obsession, however, we would urge that there are two specialities to be observed. First, the nature of the operating spirit, next that of the subject. I affirm that the spirit, in such instances, is invariably evil, and the organism of the subject invariably diseased, or, at least, mentally or physically unbalanced. Carefully investigate the subjects of possession, and you will find it inevitable that no such condition can occur until a decided lack of balance might be noticed in the organism, in some instances almost amounting to a tendency to insanity. Insanity and spiritual possession are constantly mistaken for each other. In your lunatic asylums are unbalanced minds, as you term them, who are absolutely possessed by restless, ill-conditioned, unhappy, and depraved human spirits, and these exhibit themselves through the disturbed mind or weak body in what the physician calls insanity, but the psychologist determines to be the action of spiritual possession. Nevertheless, I affirm, without being in this place or at this time able to prove my affirmation, that no such possession ever takes place in a subject who is not, previous to that possession, partly unbalanced, mentally or bodily. And thus it is that we find the pure, fair, and innocent often become subjects of this fearful calamity. You may ask wherefore such persons should be more subject to this evil than those whose tendencies are in the direction of vice? I answer you that the bad man is often as strong as the bad spirit, and it needs, in the philosophy of spiritual control, that the subject shall be weaker than the operator. Where the power is equal, the spirit may tempt, may add by his influence to the tendencies of the bad man, but he does not control them. You have noticed, in the modern spiritual movement, that woman is far more susceptible to spiritual influence than man. If your experience extends to ancient history, you will find that the Sibyl and the prophetess, though rarely the subject of historical mention, yet when described, as in the case of the Cumaean Sibyl, graphically depicted by Virgil, give evidences of a condition strongly analogous to the highly strung, susceptible, and nervous sensitives who are known amongst you today as spirit mediums. Were the true philosophy of psychology and spirit control clearly investigated as a science, it would be found that the ancient Sibyl and modern medium are of the female sex, from specialities of organism and susceptibility of mental and magnetic control, arising, not from mental imbecility, but physical susceptibility, and, I repeat, it is from these causes that women and fragile persons generally, irrespective of their mental and moral states, are more commonly the subjects of spiritual possession than men. With reference to the purpose and nature of the spirit who operates in this matter, I cannot modify my opinion that it is invariably evil, evil alike in object, tendency, and result. A good and wise spirit would realize the abnormal and injurious tendency of the control too thoroughly to practice it, hence the permanent possession of a human organism by a good spirit is unknown. As the spirit is, therefore, invariably mischievous and evil in purpose, it will be understood addresses by EHB 102, that he realizes some gratification from his pernicious act, gratification of a similar character, in fact, to that of ill-disposed and mischievous minds who love to exercise rule over others on earth, or delight in tormenting those whom they can influence. There are myriads of unhappy spirits, earthbound, as it were, by their attractions to this world, who love to hover around the scene of their vanished affections, and who find gratification in acting out evil and malicious propensities again, through the susceptibility of their suffering victims. In a word, there is, unhappily, far too much reason to understand why the demons whom human societies too abundantly manufacture in their city streets should, when landed on the shores of spirit land, long to return to the more congenial atmosphere of their earthly crimes, and gladly avail themselves of some weak or susceptible human organism to do so, for us to marvel at the action of the spirit. The greatest difficulty in the solution of the whole problem is the proper mode of cure for such cases, and in attempting to deal with this, I must again reiterate my affirmation that every subject of spiritual possession will be found physically weak, if not actually diseased, and sufficiently mentally unbalanced to become a subject for the control of the spirit. I believe the first efforts of the good physician, in such cases, should be directed invariably to the physique of his subject. As much and as constant exercise as the constitution can bear is the first prescription, legislation for the whole system, applied, of course, to special manifestation of disease, another, careful avoidance, either of undue stimulus or abstinence in diet, most essential. The force supplied by stimulant in diet is always unsafe in cases of spiritual possession, because it is far too satisfactory to the spirit to be endured for a moment, whilst the weakness induced by fasting is equally injudicious, as tending to lower the system, and therefore promote the magnetic control of the spirit. Bathing is one of the most special and invaluable aids to the cure of obsession, for magnetic and physiological reasons, which cannot at present be rendered. The best and most important mode of treatment is psychological, and in this respect infinite judgment, adapting itself to special cases, is demanded in the physician. To speak only in generalities, I would urge that the first aim of the operator shall be to distract the mind from all spiritualistic subjects, and all magnetic emotions, let the whole subject and its possibilities be studiously banished from the mind of the subject, and totally different organs than those unduly exercised be called into play. Let music, exercise, bathing, diet, strong will, healthful magnetism, pure air, constant occupation in light, trifling and interesting duties, be some of the medicaments employed, and, under the action of the paroxysms, strong, pure, and healthful magnetism be applied in mesmeric passes, accompanied by a strong will and determined purpose, and the treatment will surely be ultimately successful. I consider proper and well-assimilated magnetism, administered in mesmeric passes, as a cure which could act alone, and supersede all others, but as this agent requires careful adaptation and special conditions, both in subject and operator, I must commend the use of treatment, which would be effective without it. Question 7. Will you define the difference between soul and spirit, as used by St. Paul in the first epistle to the Thessalonians, 5th chapter, 23rd verse, I pray God your whole spirit and soul and body be preserved blameless. Addresses by EHB 103, Answer: we are asked to define the meaning attached to words which are susceptible of entirely different interpretations in the lips of different individuals. Unquestionably, Saint Paul intended simply to represent a difference between soul and spirit and body, and that such a difference exists, is the opinion of the intelligence that controls your speaker, but whether he realized the same idea that we attach to these words, is a question we are not prepared to answer, and therefore we will render you such a response as proceeds from what we feel to be a truth existing in nature, rather than an attempt to speculate upon what Saint Paul might have believed on the subject. There is a triune nature in man. The body is the material part, consisting of a structure made up from a combination of all the elements in the universe,